What's the best thing about being in New York City?
Wow.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, infographics, relevant links, book suggestions, or just to leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. I'm a Bitcoin staring, I'm staring the status quo. Got that crypto going at that foul to blow. In the algorithm, gonna get him until prison send us all to prison. Prison, that's a nerdy living. I'm a Bitcoin parent, I'm staring the status quo. Got that crypto going at that foul to blow. In the algorithm, gonna get him until prison send us all to prison. Prison, that's a nerdy living.
Ha-ha! Hi, everybody. Brett here. October 21st, 2015, the long-awaited Back to the Future Day. Do you know about this? You should if you don't live in some kind of Facebookless cave. This was the date, October 21st, 2015, that Doc Brown, Marty McFly, and Elizabeth Shue, fueled by nothing more than some old banana peels and an empty beer can, flew into at the beginning of Back to the Future Part 2. So, you know, there's been like this ongoing, you know, ooh, how similar is their predictions of the future to the actual world that we live in? You know, that kind of a thing. Whatever. It's very, very different. We have some stuff that's way cooler. Somebody who would definitely agree with that is my guest today, Jeffrey Tucker, a School Sucks Project favorite. I managed to get Jeffrey to sit down with me for about a half hour at the Liberty Fest. It was one of my top priorities. He definitely delivered, even though this discussion is short. It is one of my favorites. And here's what I need you to do as listeners to this podcast. Go to our YouTube channel. There is a video there. It is called Jeffrey Tucker, Politics, Personal Liberty, and You. I would so appreciate it if you would watch this video, if you would click the little thumbs up button on this video. Oh, you know what would be amazing? If you shared this video on Facebook, tweet it, embed it, and have it autoplay in the background when somebody opens your MySpace page. Fax it to that angry Japanese boss of yours. He could use something to loosen him up a little. However you're sharing things today, thank you so much. And I'm going to post it again in the group today. I would like people to discuss it. Do you agree with what Jeffrey said about the Ron Paul movement? Do you think the Ron Paul political movement was a net benefit to the larger liberty mission? Or was it instrumental in your personal liberty mission? Have that discussion. I can't wait to read it. But huge thanks to Jeffrey Tucker, his site, jeffreytucker.me. Also remember to check out Jeffrey's publishing platform, liberty.me. And I'll check back in with you guys in a few days with more of these Liberty Fest discussions. Thank you so much. Ooh, while you're on YouTube, check out the preview of the new bonus series. It's a collaboration with Tragedy and Hope. It's called The Deep End. And I put up a 6-minute preview called Polar Bear Propaganda. That's an intriguing title. So make sure you check that out as well. All right, everybody, here it is.
So a day ago, I set a goal for myself to interview the busiest man at the least quiet place, and I'm making it happen.
But I mean, what am I doing, really? I'm not really busy. I'm just like doing silly things all the time. So it's fine.
It looks so fun, though.
You know, it's fun. This is a fun event. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've been here. You know this.
Last time I was here at the Liberty Fest event was the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And
really?
It was in Manhattan. Wasn't in Brooklyn. Security was tight. Lots of machine guns.
Yeah.
Very intense. Made me never want to come back.
Yeah.
And in case you see these red splotches all over my shirt here.
I didn't want to ask about it.
But it's distracting you. And I kind of had the feeling that it was. So I wanted to tell you. Okay, this is the story. Last night, a few of us went into the city to see a show.
Mm.
And it was a musical comedy called How I Started the Iraq War.
Really?
It was phenomenal.
That really happened.
Yeah. I got a free ticket. And Julia and
that
I went
amazing.
With another person from the Bitcoin community. Do you know? Yeah, she lives in New Jersey. So the three of us went. Very interactive show. Like, we're sitting right in the middle of the action. It's happening around us. And it's set up like kind of like an AA meeting where people are basically admitting to themselves that they're responsible for starting the Iraq war.
That's remarkable.
Spoiler alert, hour and a half into the show, somebody gets shot. Cross the room, and the splatter of whatever that is landed on my shirt.
Actually, you know, I'm glad I didn't go to this show. Can you imagine my panic?
Oh, I know. It's food coloring. They said, because I'm sitting there.
I know, but still.
Just like this. Like, I didn't want to be this involved in
here,
the show.
And, you know, but here we are complaining about little stains on your shirt, whereas Iraq is completely ruined. You know, a whole region destroyed. Well, and we don't feel it, do we? We read about it in the news, but we don't feel it. We don't understand it.
No, not at all.
And it's egregious. Millions of displaced people. I mean, the lives of so many people ruined. You know, I was watching an interview this morning with, I think it was, I don't know, one of the Sunday talk shows, and they were interviewing Donald Trump. And Donald Trump, who, as far as I'm concerned, is just, you know, brown shirt, so I have no affection for this guy. But he's right about Iraq, you know?
Yeah.
And he said something like, it would be better for Iraq if Saddam had never been overthrown. And the reporter found that remark to be appalling, you know? And he kept pushing him on it. Like, how can you say such a thing? This guy was a horrible tyrant and so on and so on. Donald Trump, you know, speaking like actually with some sense in this case, pointed out that the entire country was destroyed. A great civilization was ruined through an imperial, you know, destructive war that ruined the lives of millions of people and created, you know, one of the greatest threats to human liberty in the world today, which is ISIS.
Yeah.
And that's all a result of the original Iraq war invasion. I mean, I'm going back to the original president, George Bush. You know, as far as I'm concerned, that's when it all began 25 years ago. You know?
Yeah.
And the fact to me was very interesting to see how this reporter was so appalled at Trump's position, you know, as if he had committed some sort of gaffe. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
By saying that. And yet it's certainly obviously true that U.S. influence over Iraq did no good for that country. I mean, they had plenty of problems. But, you know, they had an immigration problem in the sense that too many people wanted end to Iraq. I mean, it was the go-to place.
Tell me about that. I didn't know that.
No, great universities, a fabulous art scene, symphonies. It was one of the most liberal Islamic states in the region, mm-hmm. so women didn't have to wear the burqa and they could drive. Alcohol was completely legal in the country, so it was a model for what increasing amounts of liberalism would look like in the region.
Yeah,
and that was a beautiful thing. I mean, so many people went there for education. For, as I say, artists would go there to try to perform. It was a very prosperous nation. I mean. And the U.S., you know, like, took apart a burgeoning civilization.
But even if you look at the history of that place, I mean, civilization began there. Mm. And the cultural history that was, I mean, a lot of people were talking about this as early as, you know, 2004, 2005, that was completely wiped out of existence through the destruction of artwork and museums, and it turned into what it is today, which is basically like this safe ground for ISIS.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the, especially for somebody who's a fan of history like myself or like you.
25 years later, this is what we're dealing with, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, isn't it just unbelievable? I mean, it's like I am temperamentally disinclined towards a kind of radical anti-Americanism. And yet, you look at what the U.S. influence on the world, mm-hmm. and it is appalling.
It is. And you mentioned Trump. Right. And I heard usually when you're on my show, we like to have a little fun. We talk about lighter pop culture topics. Yeah, yeah. But I heard an interview with you recently. I mentioned this to you yesterday. My friend, or he's a friend of the show, Chris Stefanik, he does the show Choice Conversations.
Yes.
He had you on to talk about Trump and this increasing tone of fascism in political discourse. And I heard you say, I think it's really important to get into politics and pay attention to politics.
And
it's weird for me. I mean, look, I can't quite justify it. And I don't even want to sit here and make an apologia pro vita sua.
Yeah.
In the sense that I'm like, well, it was right in the past that I didn't care about politics, and it's right now that I do. It's it's bullshit. I mean, basically, it's a temperament thing. I feel like I'm ready for it for the first time in probably 10 or 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I would say maybe 20 years. I'm suddenly interested in it as a reflection of the ideological structures that are the controlling forces in the social order. Politics is a kind of reductio ad absurdum of those forces. And I find myself intrigued by it. And so I'm watching all the debates now, and I've never watched debates, you know, years. But no, I'm fascinated by it. Partly what's dragged me into this is the rise of Trump, because he represents such a beautiful model of a sort of an Americanist model of an interwar dictator, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested in and the ideological position he represents as a kind of controlling force in 20th century politics that we've forgotten about and we don't know about. And now here he is, 2015. We're seeing the revival of this, and we're so out of sorts, we don't even recognize it. You know, we can't even see him for what he is.
You know, my dad is a conservative, and we were talking about this a couple weeks ago, and he gets kind of irritated with me because I've had this habit, like, since, like, becoming more...
What's his issue? Every conservative has something that drives them.
You know, he fancies himself a libertarian, but then on any issue, he's really, like, just in the conservative.
Is it because he follows a particular, like, Fox News, or...?
He does, yeah. And I think he listens to a fair amount of talk radio.
There's a sort of repetition of views, and...
But he will also be the first to admit, he'll say, Brett, I'm very naive. You know, I think the Bushes are good people. And I try to tell him why they're not. And, you know, I've talked about, like, Prescott Bush and funding the Nazis. And, you know, he's like, well, that doesn't really mean much about Jeb Bush. And I'm like, you know what? Fine, Dad, it doesn't, I guess. Right. You know, I guess if your father funded the Nazis.
So he's a Jeb supporter?
I don't think he's really impressed with
left? Is he fear the left so much?
Very much.
Yeah. So this is I think a major thing going on. It's not just your father. It's people are so afraid of the left that they'll put up with any kind of authoritarian dictatorship to avoid it.
Yeah.
And this is the real power and source of fascism in the world. It was true in Italy and true in Spain and true in Germany, true in Latin America. And I think it's true in America, too.
It's really interesting that you say that, because as I've watched, and I just kind of listen here and there to, like, conservative talk radio or the Fox News pundits, just to put my ear to the street once in a while. And the way they talk about Obama and the demagoguery about Obama, and I don't, you know, obviously there's no apology here for Obama or defense of Obama, but you listen to their talking points.
Frenzied.
And I started thinking this maybe 2011, 2012, when the next election comes, when Obama can't win anymore, the conservative answer to the Barack Obama problem is going to be scary.
It's going to be worse.
And it is scary. Because we're starting to see the shape that it's taking.
Look at the Republicans' answer to Clinton, right?
I mean,
it's the same situation. And Barack Obama... Yeah, look, I'm opposed to, you know, I'm an anarchist. I don't want any government. But it was very interesting how he spent most of his political capital on Obamacare.
Yeah.
That has been a universal disaster, and almost everybody agrees with that. And now he's been humbled by that. I think 4 more years of Obama would just be an awesome thing. If we could just cancel the election and keep him in office for 4 more years, I think that's the best possible thing for liberty right now.
Interesting.
Yeah. Politics at this point has become a kind of, like, tremendously destructive and distracting thing for us. Because, I mean, look, we know where history is headed. I mean, we're seeing it all around us, right? I mean, liberty, we're breaking free of the old structures, 20th century structures of control and regimentation. We're seeing it in every sector. You know, education and housing and transportation, communication.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's glorious to see what's happening. What could stop it? You know, what's going to stop the progress? And I think the thing that's going to stop it is a new president with a mandate and a vision. You know, I mean, if we could avoid that, That would be the best.
I totally. When I heard you say this on the other show, yeah. and I was like, but I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
Because if you think about just like. This really began with Obama, and I think you see this cycle repeating now. They pump up this hope balloon, yeah. right? And then like, over eight... No, it doesn't explode. Over 8 years, it just goes... yeah. Right? Until 2015, 2016, yeah. it's empty. And now another one is pumped up as the answer.
Do we really want to go through this again? I mean, we have to see the whole swearing in and the big, the big speech. And here's my vision for America and hiring, 6,000 new bureaucrats and the entire upheaval, which is always going to, it always ends the same way and nothing at all. Because, I mean, it's all illusion, essentially. And such a distraction. It's terrible.
But you also think that at this time, this might have some educational value. And I'm wondering what it is for you. I mean, you've been involved...
Oh, politics, you mean?
Not politics directly, but I mean, you've been involved in Austrian economics for what, 30 years almost? Something like that? So, I look at you and I think about your knowledge and experience, even though we've mostly dealt with you in fun ways on this show. Here's a guy who knows a lot. He's been a lot of places.
Yeah.
He has this just incredible wealth of knowledge. What educational value... do you see in politics?
You know what I see it as is it's an opportunity to talk about important ideas.
Okay.
And that's really it. I mean, this is why I'm writing so much about the topic, because mm-hmm. I see these guys as whether it's Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, or Jeb Bush or Donald Trump mm-hmm. as being kind of archetypes. People are interested in them and who they are, and they're paying attention. So it's a chance for us to talk about them and hopefully draw into some deeper themes. It's kind of a hook into larger philosophical questions. That's the way I look at it. And I must say, I'm learning from it, too.
Mm-hmm.
To watch these various iterations of the ideological structures of our time sort of instantiate themselves into public persona. And each of them has to market themselves to the American people in some way, and to watch that process unfold gives you an interesting perspective and what it is that people think about the relationship between the individual and government.
Yeah,
I mean, that's really essentially it.
How did you feel when Ron Paul first appeared in 2007 in that scene?
To me, liberty is not really about having the right person in charge.
Of course, yeah,
and,
sure.
And the thing, even though I work for Ron and I love him dearly and he's a good friend, I always worried about those campaigns that they would send the wrong message.
Yeah.
That the answer would be to elect the right person to enact the right policies from the top. And our only job is to become wildly, insanely, fanatically, devoted to this mm-hmm. person. And, the Ron Paul movement is weird because most of the movements are better than their leader. Like the Taft, if you go back to the Taft movement, Robert Taft.
Yep.
He was never that great, but the Taftians themselves were wonderful. That's sort of the origin of modern libertarianism in America. But Ron was kind of the opposite. I always thought he was much better than his followers.
Why?
His followers were looking for a leader on the white horse to lead them to some dreamy land, to give them their rights. And Ron never believed that. I mean, he always ran as an educator,
mm-hmm.
but his followers never saw him as that. They wanted him to be a dictator. He was always Jesus, coming in from the 40 days after the fast in the desert, on Palm Sunday, and everybody's was heralding Ron as this great hero. He was like, if you've ever seen the movie Life of Brian, it's like, you're the Messiah. No, I'm not the Messiah. Oh, only the true Messiah would deny he's the Messiah. And I think Ron always had to deal with this problem. And I think it was very unfortunate in a way. I mean, Ron sought the presidency in order to give himself a kind of a stage to talk about ideas.
Yeah.
But he could never make that message stick in a way. I mean, he created this kind of relatively, robust but small movement of fanatics who found themselves dedicated to politics as a means of change. And here we are, 2015. Where are we with this movement? I mean, everybody I know who's ever deeply involved in that world is now demoralized.
Yeah, they seem to think that the goal was to get
him in office. They never understood. It's like they didn't really listen to what Ram was saying.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I've ever said what I just said publicly. So,
thank you.
Yeah. These are thoughts I've had for a long time. So I'm just telling you, that was my perception all along.
Yeah.
And my prediction was that these people, I could see it happening. This Messiah thing going on, you know, and it broke my heart in a way because it's not what Ron ever wanted. Mm-hmm. And I knew, because we all know the truth about politics, is that it leads you to nothing, you know. And people's hearts are broken, their spirits are broken, their resources, financial resources are exhausted, their emotional attachments are betrayed. I mean, that's what politics does for you.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
terrible what it does to people's spirits. And I've seen this happen now. As I say, 2015, we're 3 years after the bubble. Lots of people are gone. Mm-hmm. A lot of other people are just demoralized, is still trying to get their footing and figure. But, you know, here's the thing. We need to realize, like, now, it is not about politics. Mm-hmm. It's about the change that we can make in the spheres of life that we can control, which is mostly just ourselves.
Jeez, amen. You know, as you were talking about that, and you were talking about the White Horse Ron Paul movement, elect a leader, and the thing that was so closely tied to that was, and the Fed, right? And we talked about this 100 times on my show, but I want to get your thoughts on it. We deal with school a lot. School is a place where people, young people, feel very small. They don't feel very efficacious. They don't feel very powerful. And when people start to wake up to some of these realities of the world, especially the political world, part of the tragedy is that they suddenly gravitate to the biggest things, the furthest away from themselves,
yeah.
the hardest to control.
So interesting.
You know? And I did it. I mean, that was a big 2007 when I found Ron Paul. I was like, yeah, this guy probably should be president. Mm-hmm. But I was in a different place then. And yeah, we probably should end the Fed now that I've read a little bit about it. This doesn't sound like a good thing. Doesn't sound like it's helping us out. But all this energy that could have been devoted to like a personal liberty mission.
Right.
You know, that then can scale up.
Yeah, changing the world, changing your life, fixing up the world as far as you can control it. But I think what you said is really profound. And I think the end the Fed movement is the archetype here. Because how at the end of history, are we going to end the Fed? Is it going to be through electing the right person to office, persuading the ruling class to make money better, you know, to educate the masses, and you know, somehow, you know, the board of governors resigns and shuts down? It's not the way it's going to happen. It's going to happen through finding an end run around the existing system and building another system on top of it.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what cryptocurrency is doing right now.
Yeah.
It's creating, you know, a new kind of money and financial system out of the energies of the private sector and harnessing those brilliant forces of the market economy to create new things that are better than the old things.
Yeah.
It's the only way forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we haven't talked in about 6 months. What is a fairly recent development related to that you're excited about right now?
Oh, related to cryptocurrency?
Yeah.
I'm excited. Well, the more I think about it, I was just talking about, I had a cryptocurrency panel earlier today, and somebody asked me what I was most excited about. I'm most excited about the possibility that cryptocurrency will be able to make an end run around child labor laws, which are, I find, to be a violation of human rights. This podcast is about school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look what we've done to teenagers in this country. You know, we corral them in classrooms. We forbid them from being valuable in the marketplace on penalty of law. You know, I mean, we have truancy laws. We arrest any employer who employs anybody you know, under a certain age. I mean, it's egregious. But you think about it. If you have cryptocurrency and you can live in a digital realm and you're 14 years old and you're 13 years old and you're a marvelous programmer, photo editor, whatever, you can now go to peer-to-peer services, offer your services and get paid for it in cryptocurrency. And the bureaucracies have no control over it. I mean, it's a chance for the liberation of the youth.
I love that. You know, in real life, I have a nephew. He's about to turn 16.
Yeah.
When he was 14 years old, he was smoking pot, getting in trouble in school, getting bad grades, which is school's metric for whether or not you're doing well in school. And my brother was really out of sorts about what to do. He turned 15. He got a job. He's like, oh, my life has meaning and direction.
That's
and I have
so it.
Purpose and effect. And... not that I care about grades, but straighten himself out in school. There's nothing I can do about that he goes to school. But he straightened himself out there, stopped getting in trouble, which can be a very dangerous thing for a teenager.
You have to be valuable to the world.
And, you know, really just walks with his head held high like he's purposeful. Just scooping ice cream.
I know.
That's
it's
all it
so
took.
Awesome. Did you, you were standing here next to this little kielbasa stand. I don't know if you noticed yesterday that there was a little girl. She's maybe 6 years old.
No, I didn't.
She's working the stand here. She's because it's a family business. It's allowed under federal law. If your parents own a business, you're allowed to work for it as a family member, which is a horrible discrimination in some ways. I mean, it should be permitted for everybody. Anyway, she's about 6 years old, and she's standing up in this chair taking orders for sausages and sauerkraut and writing, you know, them down and taking the money and giving change. And it was just she's so serious. And for her, it's play acting, but not really. It's really providing value. And I looked at her and I thought, you know, all the children of the world should have this opportunity to become, to do real things, you know, to do meaningful things. And yet we forbid it. We forbid it. What are we doing? It's crazy.
What you just mentioned, this innovation or this possibility for cryptocurrency, never even occurred to me.
Yeah.
Never even thought of that.
Yeah. You don't have to have a bank account. You don't have to do anything.
But the only thing was with Bitcoin, young people have some financial freedom.
Yeah.
And that's as far as I ever really took that idea.
No.
And I've been promoting it, you know, like, hey, if there's a way, because, I mean, you could have had 10,000 of these things that you earned in some video game. You know?
That's true.
Four years ago.
Yeah.
Like, hey, will you sell me your sword?
Right.
Your virtual sword? It'll be 3,000 Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And there are people who have stories like that.
Yeah.
Like a guy who could spend 17,000 of them on a pizza.
But now it has become normal and regular. You can actually make money this way. And no matter what age you are, you can get paid in this stuff and be able to use it. I mean, imagine, you know, you're 11 years old and you know, you find a gig online and then you're able to provide services. You get paid in Bitcoin and then you can spend your Bitcoin and getting cool stuff that you want to buy online. I mean, you're almost free. I mean, how awesome is that?
It is. It's amazing.
And you can't do that through the regular banking system or nationalized money, which, I mean, our money is all bound up with regulatory state.
Yeah.
And therefore with the prison system of public school and everything else, you know, so you liberate the money, you liberate people too.
Absolutely. And then maybe someday when people start to realize some of the dysfunction in the problems in the world, they don't look for the guy on the white horse anymore.
That's the idea. I mean, it's a very interesting question. Was that a distraction or was it just a necessary building period? I don't know. I'm speaking about the last two presidential elections. I don't know. In any case, it happened. And my goal right now is let's salvage the best we can out of it.
Yeah.
And I hope that lesson is not to become hopeless, right? Not to just say, oh, if we can't get our guy elected to office, there's no hope whatsoever. My hope is that ultimately Ron Paul's legacy will be as a teacher.
Yes.
And drawing us to certain ideals. That would be awesome. But the question is then, what do you do with those ideals? And I think the answer is you find out ways to make your own life freer and gradually spread that freedom as far and wide as you possibly can from your center of where you live right now. And you know what? That's going to be essential because it's the only answer. I mean, we are not going to reform the system from the top down. It comes through decentralized, unpredictable, exciting, surprising, innovative ways from among the people, mm-hmm. you know, as starting with our own lives. And in that sense, I'm wildly optimistic and actually glad that we don't have a standard bearer at the top, you know, who's running to grant us our rights. I mean, I think we are now more aware than ever that that is not the solution. Absolutely. We have to find other solutions.
So we started in a dark place. You took us to a beautiful, sunny, bright place, as you always do.
I love your podcast.
One more chance for some of your optimism to rub off on me. What's the best thing about being in New York City?
Wow. You know, yesterday I went to a Polish deli that's only mm-hmm. a block from here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think this thing is like a century old. And it's all they do is cut meat and sell it. And it was just brilliant. And to see the benevolence between the merchants there and the customers and seeing how they're so benefit from each other's existence and such excellence at such fair prices. You know, to be in that spot, you know, was and to eat their kielbasa, you know, is just such a vision of what's possible when people are left alone to create, add value to each other's lives, to cooperate and build a better world.
And the fact that it's going on inside
right here.
This, I mean, Brooklyn is not as bad as Manhattan, which is basically like a prison island, thanks to people like
it's
Bloomberg.
Beautiful.
But even within that, you know, outside of the watchful eye, the panopticon, you do have all of
these
beautiful
intimacies.
Things.
Yeah.
And so many people who can get away.
Well,
we
all know the truth. I mean, without anarchy, the world would fall apart. You know, it's just true. And you see it all around this community here.
Absolutely. Well said.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.